All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. A packed show today. I'll tell you, it's going to be a very interesting show. At the beginning of the show, we're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor, but I'll tell you about that in a minute, because at the back end of the show, we're going to be joined by Tim White. Tim is a paleoanthropologist and a professor of integrated biology at UC Berkeley. And we're going to be talking about the recent discovery and analysis of fossils found in the Republic of Georgia. And these fossils cast a whole new light on the evolution of human beings. It's apparently getting a whole lot of people and a lot of excitement and a lot of jumping up and down around these things. And we're going to find out why, what the significance of this is. Before that, we'll be talking with David Rosen, a writer and commentator, about the unspoken epidemic of rape and sexual assault, sexual violence among young people in the U.S. And David writes regularly on public policy, media, technology, politics, and sexuality. Now, we are trying to get Sansara Taylor on the phone right now, and we're hoping that that's going to work. And let me see, is Sansara on there now?
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm good, Sansara. How are you?
Boy,
you know, this has been the story of my day today. You know, I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I started working. I'm doing all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, everything, the CDs aren't burning, printers aren't running, traffic jams.
Oh. And then yeah. Technology, Michael, technology.
Yeah, exactly. We got to do something about that. Anyway, Sansara, good to talk with you again. And as I remember, the last time we spoke on air was you were in Jackson, Mississippi, and you're back there now. And the situation that's going on in Jackson has been described as one of the key concentrations of the war on women these days. And you've described it as a state of emergency. Can you tell people what's going on in Jackson, Mississippi? And you're down there defending the last remaining clinic, abortion clinic in all of Mississippi. What's going on down there now? Why is it such a state of emergency?
Well, I definitely want to talk about that, but I have to tell you, this morning I woke up. I didn't have printer problems or CD burning problems, but I looked at the cover of the New York Times online, and I discovered, and so I'll get back to Jackson, but I discovered that there is one of the most outrageous, I mean, just infuriating federal court rulings that has the implications that a lot of the laws that were passed in Texas that will close down abortion clinics. 3 days ago, there was a ruling at the federal level saying that one of those laws will be thrown out. It was bogus. These clinics will stay open. 3 days later, just yesterday, a higher court ruled that this law will be implemented. And so starting today, there are at least as many as 13 abortion clinics in Texas, which will no longer be providing abortions to women throughout Texas. So I do want to say that, you know, I want to talk about what I'm doing here in Jackson, Mississippi. It is a state of emergency, but this really underscores how urgent and how intense a state of emergency there is confronting women's right to abortion in every state across this country. And yes, it's particularly intense in the rural states, in the southern states. Here I am in the deep south in Jackson, Mississippi. But this is everybody's responsibility, and it's happening nationwide. So here in Jackson, as you said, there's only one abortion clinic left in the entire state. It is out of reach to a great many people throughout this region. I mean, the clinic it serves overwhelmingly African American women, overwhelmingly women in poverty, overwhelmingly women who already have children that they're struggling to care for, and people have to travel great distances to get here. They have to then stay overnight or make the trip twice because there's a bogus, medically unnecessary mandatory waiting period. There's a 16-week cutoff on abortions. There's requirements that say the doctors who practice here have to be OBGYNs when you could do safe abortion procedures, even if you have a different specialization. So that restricts the number of doctors who can serve here. And the doctors who work at this clinic, they fly in from out of state. They're very committed, but they have to fly in because it's unsafe to live and practice in Mississippi, in places like Alabama, in a lot of these places that have only one clinic. So already this clinic is in an utter state of emergency, and women's rights and ability to control their reproduction is in a state of emergency. But there's two other things coming, kind of mounting on top of all that, that are hitting kind of the perfect storm or the horrific storm in Jackson here, which is that they have passed in this last year a law that would require these doctors who fly in from out of state to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. This is medically unnecessary. Abortion is 10 times safer than childbirth. Hospitals already have to admit a patient if there is an emergency. There's no reason a hospital would bar a patient. There's nothing that this does to protect the safety of women. But this law is designed to close down abortion clinics because the doctors who come in from out of state will not be able to get those admitting privileges. And this is actually the law that is being upheld right now in Texas that could close as many as 13 clinics. This is a law that's being tried in Alabama, in Wisconsin, in North Dakota, and here in Jackson that would shut down this clinic. This law has been passed here, and it's temporarily being stayed while it goes through the courts. So that's looming. And then on top of that, this week, a Christian fascist organization, a Christian fascist terroristic organization that has been associated with clinic violence over the years and just incredible demonization of doctors who do abortions, of women, condemnation, biblical literalists, they are declaring and laying siege to this clinic for the next week here in Jackson. So we came down here to stand up against that, to say that we cannot let the women of Mississippi stand alone in the face of this. We cannot let the doctors, the providers, the clinic owner and staff, the local organizers and activists who are heroically and courageously standing up to this, people in Wake Up Mississippi and the Hell No campaign down here in Jackson are standing up to this, but it's everybody's responsibility around the country. That's why we came down here. So I know that's a mouthful, but it's even more a state of emergency than it was when you first invited me on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly sounds that way. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org, and she was one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride this summer, and where she visited Jackson, Mississippi in solidarity with the people fighting to defend the last remaining abortion clinic in Mississippi. And she's back there now to stand up against the current state of emergency, as she was just describing. Now, Sansara, you mentioned the particularity of this week being that there was that there's this Christian fascist organization that has basically called for a rallying point, an all-out assault against the clinic. Tell people who this organization is, what they're about, and what their plans are.
Okay, so you know, a lot of people think that the fight over abortion is one of maybe a misunderstanding. You know, that we should respect both sides. There's extreme positions. Can't we just kind of find a middle ground? But I think that the reality of what this fight is actually about, that it's never been about babies and it's always been about the social role of women, is very, very clearly displayed by the group that's coming here to Jackson. And it's not unique to them, but they're more open about it than most of the anti-abortion leaders, in the sense that they admit openly. The group is called Operation Save America, and they admit very, very openly that they are motivated by the biblical mandate, by the biblically literalist view that women's duty is to bear children. Women, according to the Bible, a literalist interpretation of the Bible, it was Eve that caused Adam to eat from the tree of knowledge. We, you know, caused original sin, got kicked out of the Garden of Eden, caused man to be fallen. And everything, if you think about it, with the religious tradition, everything bad that has ever been done, the so-called sinful nature of human beings, is because of this woman, Eve. And for punishment for that, there are verses in the Bible, in Timothy, that say that women have a special curse on them, that women can only redeem themselves if they bear children and if they obey their husbands. And this really is the core message of Operation Save America. This is why they are coming down here. This is why they've been terrorizing clinics for decades across the country. I remember the first time I interacted with them was actually a number of years ago up in North Dakota at the only abortion clinic there. Almost 2 decades ago, I first defended an abortion clinic. And I at the time thought, you know, they're Christians. I was Christian. I'm no longer a Christian. But I thought maybe there's some misunderstanding I could get through to them. And then they were praying not for the lives of babies, but they were praying, Lord, break this curse of independence that has afflicted women. And they really are against abortion because they're against women being able to live full lives and determine their destinies. They're also against birth control, like the whole pro-life movement is against birth control. So I think this is sort of the message. Last time they were in Jackson, they burnt a Quran. They're on a crusade mission against Islam. They are extremely anti-gay. They are openly about the subordination of women. And they will be at the clinic intimidating and terrorizing people at the clinic. They get out there with their huge, bloody, distorted, and grotesque fetal pornography pictures that they claim are aborted fetuses and try to really shock and upset people. They preach their Christian fundamentalist fascist Bible interpretation of the Bible all over the city and try to influence broad public opinion. They have not posted all of their events for the week. So we don't actually know all of what they're planning, but they are going to be here a full week, and their track record is that they do a lot of things to incite people, to incite violence. They've been associated with releasing flyers that have the names and the faces and the addresses of doctors who do abortions that is making it dangerous for those doctors, and they create an atmosphere of violence against those doctors and other providers. So this is all a part of the mix of what's happening this week here in Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And she was one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride this summer, and where she visited Jackson, Mississippi, in solidarity with the people fighting to defend the last remaining abortion clinic in Mississippi. And she's back there now to stand up against the current state of emergency, as she was just describing. Yeah, I was going to comment on that this is actually a very, not just, you know, well, they're a wacko organization or the whatever, but these are very dangerous people. And in terms of them going out and whipping up the kind of atmosphere that creates and sort of is the ground in which a lot of these fascist nuts that go out and have killed, and you know, attacked and killed, physically attacked right. and killed a number of abortion providers. It's very, very heavy. Dr. Tiller, for instance, you know, the whole atmosphere that was created by Operation Rescue at the time and all this other stuff was sort of, that was one of the things that people were citing as that what encouraged this guy to go out and kill Tiller, or made him feel that he had the, you know, biblical authority to go out and kill Tiller. Tell me this, though. One of the things, when you're talking about all that, you have that, and then you have the situation of this clinic, and then you have the people of Jackson. What kind of response have you been getting from the people of Jackson, Mississippi? Because I did get a chance this morning to skim some of the things, one of your first dispatches, which I would encourage everyone to go to revcom.us and to stoppatriarchy.org and look at these dispatches, because it'll be, you know, regular, you know, you filling people in on what's going on. But let's talk about the response of the people in Jackson to this assault on the clinic and what they think about the clinic itself.
I'm really glad you asked that, because yeah, the last time we were here, and I was on your show with the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, we had such a focus. We were traveling so many places, and it was right that we did it, but we were so focused, we didn't have as much time to get out into the community of Jackson. And we've been able to do that since we've been here. Jackson is a city that it's 80% African American. It's got extremely high levels of poverty among African Americans. And it is a city that, you know, if you go on the internet and look up Jackson, which I did before we came here, you know, it looks like a happening place with a happening downtown and a cultural scene, and there's some of that going on. But you go just a few blocks outside of that, and you are in, you know, driving through places that look like they haven't changed in 100 years. With black communities, shotgun houses falling apart, empty, you know, abandoned structures where you can see the sky right through the skeleton of the building, where it's just, and people are living interspersed between empty lots and abandoned property and property that's falling down. And so there's an incredible amount of poverty. And we've been out, and a lot of these are the communities that most, you know, in Jackson and then around the state are communities that really rely on this clinic, because women who live in poverty, women who lack decent education, women who lack basic health care coverage, they have the lowest use of contraception, and they have the highest rates of unplanned pregnancy. That's not surprising. They also have a great need for abortion, and impacts on their lives. So we've been out, and, you know, we're in the Deep South, and religion is very thick, and there's a lot of religious opposition to abortion that we've encountered. We've especially spent a lot of time at Jackson State University, which is a predominantly black college. It's actually one of the colleges where students were killed during anti-Vietnam War protests years ago. And, you know, so it's got an interesting history. And we've been talking to students and hearing, you know, a lot of religious opposition to abortion, but also what keeps coming through, even with those who feel conflicted about it, is a very strong, and I would say actually overwhelming, among the people we've spoken to, support for women's right to abortion. And very, very heavy, very immediate, and very intimate and closely connected to people's lives. Very common. We're hearing stories of women in extreme circumstances of poverty, of abuse, of different circumstances where they either needed an abortion and were not able to get one, or they had to go through, you know, tremendous, tremendous hardship to get an abortion. I was talking to a group of young black men at Jackson State who stopped, and one of them in particular, he was soft-spoken, but he was had strong conviction about abortion rights. And I asked him, I said, you must know women who've needed this. And he said, yes, ma'am. Everybody in the South says, ma'am. He said, yes, ma'am, I do. And so we were talking, and I said, well, you know, did you know that there's only one clinic in the whole state? He said, no, I didn't know that. But I know that I'm from the coast, and down on the Gulf Coast, he says, and there was no clinic there. So I said, these women that you know, did they have to come all the way up here to Jackson then? How did that work for them? And he said, no, ma'am. Those women, they didn't get the abortions. And he then proceeded to tell me the impact this had on these young women that he grew up with, cousins of his, friends in high school, who many of them, you know, they didn't even have a place to stay. They were staying with relatives, you know, the home, couch to couch, first on as a pregnant woman and then with a child. He described, you know, the struggle that the strain it put on the entire family that was already under extreme strain, economic, and then watching these children grow up, some of the time going to bed hungry. And we heard these stories over and over again. And already right now, I think people need to understand this, right now, women are being forced to have all the horrific consequences of a child they cannot care for and do not want. And we heard these stories over and over again. A young guy, I'll tell one more story. People need to know this. A young guy that we talked to came from a very poor school in Detroit, the ghettos in Detroit, and he said, I went to a very poor school, and he started talking about how girls that he knew, first he said he knows that women will risk their lives if they can't get an abortion, trying to abort a fetus. And I thought he was, you know, my immediate thought, most of the time when I've talked to people, they have a family story of this, a grandmother or a great aunt or somebody they know in the history of their family. So I asked him if this was a story that he heard from his parents, and he said, no, ma'am. Actually, he didn't say ma'am because he was from Detroit, but he said, no, these were girls he went to high school with, girls in the inner city of Detroit, who he said, you know, they were too poor to get an abortion. They were embarrassed to tell their parents. They were very young. And he described girls that he knew who took pills, have a lot of pills to try to get sick, girls he knew who put sharp objects up inside their bodies. This is what's happening now. And so we've been out there collecting these stories, but also rallying these students and other people that we've been talking to say, you know, if you don't stand up now, this right is being taken away. And we've gotten a tremendously deep response among people. I have to say it's a very deep response among people. And students have joined with us in getting the word out to others, taking the flyers into their dorms, joining with us and doing outreach. And we're planning to bring a lot of them with us to stand with this clinic in the coming days.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And she was one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride this summer, and where she visited Jackson, Mississippi, in solidarity with the people fighting to defend the last remaining abortion clinic in Mississippi. And she's back there now to stand up against the current state of emergency, as she was just describing. Now, Sansara, I have two more questions, and we only have about 5 more minutes. So what I'm going to do is be real quick.
Okay.
And this first one, I was really intrigued by, because in the dispatch that you filed this morning, there was a point you made about how it really proved to be very important to not only pose this as a question of what people should do about choice and about the extreme circumstances of some women, but the importance of actually getting into it with people about the science behind this. Because I thought it was very important in terms of how people think and what difference it makes for people to actually understand reality and what the world is about and how things and different expressions of this in terms of even understanding what is a fetus, what's abortion, all of that. That was really intriguing to me, and the difference that makes in doing that.
Well, I think it's true. People, fetuses are not babies. This is we keep talking about this with people because it's true and because people don't know this and they've never been told this. Fetuses are not babies. Fetuses are a subordinate part of a woman's body. You know, an acorn is not the same as a tree. A fetus is not the same as a baby. It has the potential to become a baby. It will grow into that, but only if it's part of a woman's body, part of her circulatory system, part of her taking in nutrients, breathing the oxygen. If she is the human being, and it is part of her that's developing. Until it's born, it's part of her body, and it's part of her. And this was, you know, I really recommend that people do go to revcom.us and go into... If you go into the navigate through the Revolution Newspaper page and then click on the right-hand side, there's a whole spread about the abortion rights struggle that we're doing. There's an installment called A Fetus is Not a Baby that really goes into the science of this and the science of what an abortion actually is, and we want to demystify that. A lot of pro-choice people are afraid to talk about that, and I think we have to go there. The people have been denied science. They've been denied an understanding of human biology and reproduction, and we have to demystify that and tell the truth that fetuses are not babies, abortion is not murder, and women are not incubators. So that's been a very important part of our engagement here.
Okay. One last question. The relationship between what's happening in Jackson and the overall war on women that's rapidly intensifying, and to talk about that from both sides, you know, the relationship, what is it that's concentrated in Jackson for both sides?
Well, I think that on one level, on a basic level, it's immoral for anybody in any part of this country to abandon the women of Mississippi, to abandon the heroic doctors who risk their lives every day to provide abortions for these women, to abandon the provider, the Jackson Women Health Organization, to abandon the people who are on the ground here. I think it's immoral, even if it was the only place there was an attack happening. But the other part of it is that it's delusional to think that these attacks are not part of a national assault and that they won't spread and that clinics won't close everywhere across this country if we don't stand up and resist this now. And it is everybody's responsibility nationally to stand up. And the more that people see resistance, if you can come to Jackson, go to stoppatriarchy.org, find out how to get here. It's not too late to come down here. If you can't, you should send a video message of support. You should go out to the courthouse today, wherever you are today and tomorrow, with signs that say abortion on demand without apology. Stand up in solidarity with the Jackson Clinic and also condemn this new ruling that will affect Texas women. Find a way to get connected. Go to stoppatriarchy.org or go to revcom.us. And I really have to say right now, no one, especially with what's happening on the ground here this week, the terror that will be inflicted, and especially with this new ruling in Texas, I think no one can really have a clean conscience if you stand on the sidelines at a historical pivot moment like this. Women's lives are being foreclosed, their rights are being revoked. It does not have to stay that way. We can reverse this, we can turn the tide, but we have to get out there and fight and resist and mobilize others. We have to rely on ourselves, not on politicians. We have to mobilize in the streets in visible resistance, and we have to tell the truth and change the terms that this is about women's lives and women's liberation, and that abortion is a perfectly moral, absolutely necessary right, and that it needs to be available on demand and without apology. And there is a place for everybody to donate money, to send a message, to come down here, and to spread the word in many different ways. So I'll leave you with that.
All right, Sansara, thank you very much. And we need to have you back when after this week is over so you can give us basically an assessment of what happened and other things you've learned, all right?
I would love to do that. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, great. Talk to you later. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. You're the host and producer of the show. I don't know why I'm saying that right now, but we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org, and she's reporting live from the front lines of the battle to defend the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, the Jackson Women's Health Organization. All right, and before we leave this segment, I just want to remind people that it would be really great if people went to revcom.us, that's the website, revcom.us, and what you'll find there is you'll find a really mind-blowing, basically an issue of Revolution Newspaper, a special issue of Revolution Newspaper, a declaration on the oppression of women and the liberation of women, what it's going to take to liberate them. So go there, check it out. Let me know what you think about it, all right? And meanwhile, I want to read something from Bob Avakian, and this is a quote from his book, Basics, and it's all about the oppression of women. So let's talk about that now. So listen up. Look at all these beautiful children who are female in the world. And in addition to all the other outrages which I have referred to in terms of children throughout the slums and shantytowns of the third world, in addition to all the horrors that will be heaped on them, the actual living in garbage and human waste in the hundreds of millions as their fate laid out before them, yes, even before they are born, there is, on top of this, for those children who are born female, the horror of everything that this will bring simply because they are female in a world of male domination. And this is true not only in the third world. In modern countries, like the U.S. as well, the statistics barely capture it. The millions who will be raped, the millions more who will be routinely demeaned, deceived, degraded, and all too often brutalized by those who are supposed to be their most intimate lovers. The way in which so many people will be shamed, hounded, and harassed if they seek to exercise reproductive rights through abortion or even birth control. The many who will be forced into prostitution and pornography. And all those who, if they do not have that particular fate And even if they achieve some success in this new world, where supposedly there are no barriers for women, will be surrounded on every side and insulted at every moment by a society and a culture which degrades women on the streets, in the schools and workplaces, in the home, on a daily basis, and in countless ways. And that's from Bob Avakian, and you can find it in his book, Basics, from the Talks and Writings of Bob Avakian. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with David Rosen, writer and commentator, talking about the epidemic of sexual violence and sexual assault among young people. Stay tuned. Welcome back. They Don't Really Care About Us with Michael Jackson, all right? And I thought that was a good way to talk about this. Well, it's a part of the theme of the whole show today. They don't really give a damn about us, and we got to stand up and stand up against this and understand what the society is doing to people. Joining us now is David Rosen. David regularly contributes to Alternate Brooklyn Rail, filmmaker in the Huffington Post. And I came across a piece of his in Counterpunch, and he was talking about the unspoken epidemic of sexual violence among young people. And I just wanted to talk about that because I thought it's really important for people to understand. So we're going to have a segment on that right now. I really want to welcome David to the show. David, welcome, man.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this. You seem to be really struck by the fact that this is, in fact, this is an unspoken epidemic. Sexual violence among young people is an unspoken epidemic. It's something that exists, that's very heavy, but it's unspoken. And let's talk about that. What do you mean an unspoken epidemic?
Over the last couple of years, there have been sort of periodic, the media has focused periodically on a series of rape cases that perhaps you're aware of, like last year was in Steubenville, Ohio. I don't know if you were the...
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and then another one in Maryville, Missouri, and others that have popped up here and there. And they've drawn attention to the issues confronting not only the involving the young, the boys and the girls themselves, but also the way that the communities around them, especially in Steubenville and where these are... Older, first and foremost, they're white young men who are often involved in the athletics departments, either baseball or football teams, etc. And that's got the attention, and rightly so, because these things are so shameful in terms of not only what the kids, boys did, but what the community did to rally in support of these boys. And also, in a number of these cases, where local law enforcement officials chose to sort of give it a wink and a nod and dismiss it as merely, you know, just play among kids. what I was struck by, I have two daughters, so I'm particularly concerned about this issue, you know, just for my own life. But what I was struck by and what got me started was the peculiar occurrence that I was, Journal of the American Medical Association published a very interesting report, which just blew me away, that there was talking about sexual violence, and that it's that in all the ways in which intimidation is used, predominantly by boys against girls, but also sometimes the other way, it's that about 10% of the kids in the United States, 14 through 21, have been victim of some form of violence. Not all of it rape, please. And it's only a small, maybe 2-3% of that. But upwards of 10% have reported themselves being coerced, forced into sexual engagements that they really didn't want to, but they were, by peer pressure or by alcohol in some cases, been forced into this compromising and not sort of consensual acts. And so I was very shocked to read that. First of all, then the most peculiar part of this whole thing was that in a completely separate study, just happened to be looking at it, that came out from the Justice Department was really about what goes on in youths who are incarcerated in this country and the essential sexual violence that takes place in the jails and the prisons and in the United States. And it's weird because it turned out to be around the same 10%, 9.5%. Of these youths are also being subjected to sexual violence. And again, I'm just posing the... I was trying to abstract from this very specific cases that have gotten a good deal and of media attention to the larger context in which violence of a sexual nature seems to be taking place. I called it an epidemic because it seems scary to me that you got 10% of these kids being subject to some kind of violence, and very little discussion is being done about it. And so that's why I wrote the article.
Well, tell me this, David. Give people a sense of the real numbers of that. When we talk about 10%, 1 in 10 young people is a victim of sexual violence. What are we talking about in terms of real numbers right now?
Well, that's what one of the things I try to do is extrapolate back from the numbers that the researchers reported. And so I went back to the U.S. Census Bureau numbers, and you end up with something that children, that is young people, 14 to 21, constitute about 34 million people in the United States. And if you just take 9%, which is the number I used, which is what they use, you're dealing with 3.1 million. Over 3 million kids a year find themselves subject to some form of sexual coercion and what they call sexual violence. The researchers call sexual violence. That's a lot of kids. I mean, to me, as I pointed out in the article, I don't mean this to take any away from the suffering that people go through, but quote unquote, only 1.1 or 2%, 1.1 million people in the United States are infected with HIV, and we consider that an epidemic. So this is three times more, and nobody's saying anything about it. At least I don't see anybody really talking about it as an issue. And there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle, and I don't want to minimize the complexity of it. And I don't consider myself to be an expert, or I'm not a psychologist or involved with the school system. In this capacity, I'm a writer, and I was just trying to identify or flag an issue I think that should be discussed more, not only in terms of what goes on in the classroom and sex education, but the peer pressure issues that essentially isolate or at least permit this kind of goings-on within the community groups of the kids who often find themselves, the peer pressure that they're faced with.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to David Rosen, a writer and commentator who writes regularly on public policy, media, technology, politics, and sexuality, and we're talking about the unspoken epidemic of rape and sexual assault among young people in the U.S. today. David, I want to ask you this question, and we can talk about it a little bit, and then we'll have to move on, but I wanted to ask you this because I thought it was very important. One of the things that the Journal of American Medicine's study said, they said that there was a very close tie-in between violent pornography, violent sexual images,
right.
And people perpetrating that out on after that, you know, in the world. And I kept thinking about that in relation to this. You know, if you think about the things that we've seen about the prevalence of rape in the military and the way that, you know, women are treated in, you know, in other countries when the U.S. Army goes in and, you know, rampages through there, or in, you know, Abu Ghraib, and the kind of sexually demeaning, you know, torture that was going on and all this stuff. And you think about the ethos that's being perpetrated throughout the entire society, and then how that all is fed by this really warped view of lesser people or people who have been objectified and dehumanized, and then the need to create this sort of, I mean, there's these unseen forces creating a really terrible, you know, core of people who their morality, you know, in terms of how they treat other people and look at other people, is just conditioned by the most horrific, you know, okays for sexual violence and for everything else. It's really, really disturbing.
I completely agree with you. I mean, it's scary to me because, you know, there's a lot, and I don't want to appear to be sort of one of these sort of, you know, right-wing kind of moralists who are saying, you know, it's all the fault of the media, the liberal establishment, blah, blah, blah. What I was trying to tie, the incidence of this among particularly white young men was the part that I found the most peculiar. You know, and I, in the conclusion of this article, try to talk about it not only in terms of like the X-rated videos, et cetera, that are easily accessible through the web, et cetera, but more so a sort of social crisis that is what I think is really at the heart of this, about what happens to young people's sense of the future. Can they look forward to a life that's as we, you know, I don't know about you, but, you know, where I was raised, at least, was a sense one could, so your parents, and I'm, you know, do it so that you can live a better life than your parents did, you know, that they pass you forward, if you will. And I have a sense that at the heart of a lot of this is the sense that there's no future for a lot. A lot of kids don't feel a future, especially the privileged white kids who feel, white young men, who are sort of championed as, you know, on the varsity teams or, you know, whatever, that for them there's real questions about what is their future, where is it going. We see elements, I think that panic is also, that panic is really at the heart of what motivates the Tea Party, is the kind of white fright about the fact that a particular generation is being socially and economically and demographically eclipsed. Mm-hmm. And it leaves people, I think, with a sense of panic. And I don't believe I have the wherewithal to actually fully explain this, but I just can't help but not try to have a variety of pieces that are fueling something, not only for the individual, that are feeding into this process for the individual, but also socially, where you know, this country is in the middle of a major restructuring of its economic and political sort of wherewithal in the world. And I think one of the outcomes is that people don't know what tomorrow will bring them. And I think you see this with these kids. I mean, that's what I'm sort of pointing to.
All right, David, we're going to have to wrap this up, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. Take Bye care, now. Man. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with David Rosen, a writer, about the epidemic of sexual violence among youth. And I just have to say, you know, as I was listening to David and we were talking, and he's talking, he's laying all this out, I kept thinking about what this system creates. Once again, you want to think about reasons to get rid of this system. Think about what this system creates, the kind of ethos that it's propagating throughout all these things. You know, yes, there's all kinds of upheaval and there's all kinds of people being unsure of what the future holds. And what are they going in and doing? There's a lot of struggle between the different elements of the rulers of this country. And what are they organized around? What are they united around creating the kind of ethos that is anti-gay, anti-black, anti-people in other countries, anti-women? You know, all of these things that actually go against the people they can define as the cause of all this, and then rally this fascistic social base. This is something that everyone needs to pay attention to. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Tim White to talk about the Skull 5 and what difference it makes in the world. Okay, so you'll hear and learn all about that when we come back. All right. It's really hard to stop that one. Okay, it's really hard to stop that one. In fact, all the people that I'm listening, that I'm looking at in the control room are dancing, and they seem to be having a lot of fun, all right? And I'm sitting in a chair talking to you. That's a lot of fun, too. And hopefully a lot of you are out there dancing after that one. That was the Douglas Street Shuffle from Maracutu, New York. And I played that because I was going back and forth. I was going to play something about called the scientific strut. And I was thinking, okay, how would I introduce this? But I thought, you know, this Douglas Street Shuffle is really celebratory and kind of puts us in the right mood for what we're going to talk about next. You know, just recently, in mid-October, there was an announcement that there had been a really significant discovery, and it had to do with the fossils found in the Republic of Georgia. And it said, and it was particularly this one skull, skull number 5, and it said that this casts important new light on the evolution of human beings. The earliest now extinct human ancestors, once thought to be multiple species, may have actually been one species. And joining us to talk about that is Tim White. Tim is a professor of integrative biology at UC Berkeley. He is known for his work on Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, who lived 3.2 million years ago, and I'll never be able to pronounce this one, Ardipithecus remedus, about 4.4 million years ago. And he's here to talk with us about skull number 5. All right, Tim, how are you?
I'm very good this morning. How are you?
Good. Welcome, too, man. Really looking forward to talking with you.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. What is skull number 5, and why is it so damn important?
Well, it's a follow-up of your shuffle music there, because it's all about feet moving. For the first 5 million years of our lineage, the line that led to our species, Homo sapiens, we were African creatures. And then sometime around 2 million years ago, the first of our ancestors expanded the geographic range beyond Africa, and this is the very earliest evidence outside the African continent of humans evolving.
Okay, so now when you look at this, and you know, it has been it's sort of the front page of the LA Times, you know, and it was sort of people are looking at it and they're thinking, okay, well that's interesting what you're just saying, but then. Is that something that merits, is this like, you know, I think you've described this as sort of a watershed moment in the science of evolution. What is it that actually makes that difference?
Well, what we see in the geography of this find is something centered in the old world. And particularly Eurasia has been a kind of a black hole until these discoveries in the Republic of Georgia. You're about halfway between Spain and Indonesia. We've known that this species, Homo erectus, known for many years that it's ranged all the way across that geography at a million years ago, but we haven't understood where those creatures evolved from and how they connect back to our African ancestors, where the record is pretty good. So this discovery in Georgia is important geographically, but it's also very important because it's a very, very rich site, rich not only in the fossil remains of these ancestors, but also in behavioral evidence as to what they were doing. And this gives us great insight into what really was a revolutionary leap in human origins. And we've only been able to find this out since these discoveries in the 1990s and then extending on till today. Skull number 5 is just the most recent in a string of these skulls from this site, and there are other body parts represented.
And what is it about skull 5 that, you know, like, you know, even calling it the whole thing, you know, I remember the front page of the LA Times said, well, you know, new skull, new fossil lays the ground for understanding that we all may have been one species, that all the differences that people have been talking about over the years, the various Homo groupings that were going on. What is it? What is it about the skull? You know, what is it that, again, singled it out? And what difference does it make in terms of, will it make in terms of this question of, is it all Homo erectus or is it a bunch of other, still a bunch of other species?
Well, the fossil record of human evolution is fairly fragmentary, so that's why the fossils like Lucy and Ardi get kind of popular names, because they're so complete. Normally what we find are jaws and teeth and a piece of a head here and there. We try to date it, and then people put different names on these. When we look at any mammal species, we see variation, and that's no different in our species. We know that females are, on average, smaller in body size than males. We know that children are smaller than adults. So there's an extent of variation, whether you're talking about ourselves or species such as our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees. For fossil species, you obviously need skulls of men, women, and children to understand the biological variation. Once you have a population, like the one that's now come out of this site in Georgia, you can use it as a yardstick and measure other more fragmentary fossil evidence in other parts of the world. So for the African discoveries that are slightly older than this, when you apply that yardstick, a lot of the names that have been used to describe the more fragmentary fossils looks like the paleontologists who use those names made what we call classification errors. They divided one species into too many species, and we've now been able to apply the yardstick and look at that. So it makes some controversy go away in that sense. I think more importantly, though, is the behavioral evidence associated with these people. The large skull number 5 is an obvious male individual. There are smaller individuals, including a youngster and females from this site, and they're all found right on top of a lava flow in some rock overhang, and the carnivores, saber-toothed cats, very, very large cheetah, living in this area were killing largely things like four-footed ungulates, dragging the carcasses back into this location, and these early hominids knew that that location was a place they could procure meat and marrow. And it's probably in the course of those procurement activities where they approach these carnivore lairs, probably quite cautiously, but sometimes not cautiously enough, and they themselves became the prey, so their bones remained there in the ground. They were buried. They rested there for about 1.8, 1.9 million years, buried, and then sort of the end of geological time, and for us it seems really early, but in medieval times, there was a village called Dimanisi, and these medieval people built houses, and as they dug the basements in these houses, they encountered fossils. Well, later in the middle part of the last century, paleontologists got involved and looked at those bones and said, these bones are really ancient, and the first jawbone found there was from a female. So we haven't known what a large male individual looked like until Skull 5 was found, and by extending that biological range, it allows us to understand the variation of these first people, and not only the variation, but the fact that they were anatomically very, very different from ourselves. And when you have a very large segment of the population imagining that humans were created in their present form 4,000-some years ago, they have a little explaining to do, the creationists, at this point, because it's obviously not an ape, and obviously it is not a human being. It's 1.8 million years ago, centered in the old world, undertaking behaviors that no other primate exhibits.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad you brought that up because I want to get into that right now. But first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Tim White, and we're talking about the recently published analysis of fossils found in the Republic of Georgia, which casts an important new light on the evolution of human beings. All right, now, Tim, exactly that point. You know, there are a lot of people who try to go against evolution. They try to go against evolution, and they you know, or even you know, people who accept the fact of evolution, actually. Maybe I should put it that way. There are most people who accept the fact of evolution, who accept science, have heard arguments from a lot of people that there are no transitional forms. That's one of the things these creationists that you're referring to constantly bring up. Oh, yeah? Well, there are huge gaps in the fossil record. You know, and they keep saying that there's no transitional forms. There's nothing like to prove that there's sort of a step-by-step or anything like that. They don't look at things like punctuated equilibrium. They don't look at things like, you know, leaps in development, things like that. But they just say no transitional forms. What does Skull 5 have to do with, what's it say about that? What's new about Skull 5 in relation to that, and what isn't?
Well, Skull 5 shows a very small brain capacity, much smaller than modern humans today. Skull 5 shows that below the neck, these people are capable, as you and I, of upright bipedal locomotion. So there's no mistaking the fact when you have men, women, and children all from one stratigraphic horizon, very well dated to nearly 2 million years ago, no mistaking the fact that this is neither an ape nor a human. In fact, it's about two-thirds of the way along that line that came to us after we split from the lines that led to the African apes. The evidence for this evolution is now overwhelming, and it comes from three relatively independent sources. First, in the days of Darwin, they had comparative anatomy because there was virtually no fossil record, and what you said was accurate in the middle of the 1800s. And that is, there were many, many, many gaps in the fossil record. But those of us who work in Africa, and I'm here in Los Angeles today, with about 1,300 other paleontologists who study everything from dinosaurs to birds to small mammals to fish. And all of us have been involved during our lifetimes, following other scholars in the past, at amassing a gigantic collection of fossil evidence. You can actually go to the Natural History Museum down in Los Angeles. Wonderful new exhibits down there, and see these amazing dinosaur fossils and so on and so forth. So these biblical ideas of a Noah's Ark, of a creation 4,000 years ago, those are just flying now in the face of a great deal of evidence. Fossil hominids are really hard to find relative to dinosaurs, and that's because our ancestors were smart. There were never very many of them on the landscape, and you don't find very many of their remains, which is why this Georgian paleontology site with all of their remains in a carnivore lair is opening up a new vista, opening up lots of new evidence, and that evidence now is going to join a larger body of evidence crossing the last 6 million years that shows to anyone reasonable enough to consider the evidence that we evolved. And then when we look at an independent data source now available to us, we find that genetically there is evidence for evolution that shows we are very closely related to the chimpanzees, a little more distantly related to gorillas, and even more distantly related to orangutans. But all of these species in life's tree are related, and they're related through common ancestors. And it was Darwin who made that breakthrough notion in his notebooks in 1837. He drew the family tree in his notebook. He lacked the fossil evidence. Today we have the fossil evidence, but we've added this incredible genetic evidence as well. So independent confirmation that we evolved. And I think a lot of the evolution deniers out there, when confronted with things like the evolution of bacteria, they accept it. Not an issue. We know that there are antibiotic resistant bacteria. And those very creationists are the first ones to request the drugs. And the drug development is a little bit behind the advancing front of bacterial evolution. And that's a big problem that people in medicine are having to cope with. It's a problem that is based in evolution. Indeed, all of our understanding of life, all the way from ecology to bacteria to medicine, all of it is based on the fundamental principles of evolutionary biology. When it comes to humans, people have been a little bit nervous, I suppose, for a lot of historical, religious, faith-based reasons. But many people, including most religious people, look at that evidence and say, well, this evidence is very clear. It's very strong. We did evolve. That's reality. And so when you have real fossils showing real intermediates, such as these from Georgia, that's just another piece of the overall puzzle. We're still actively working on filling more of those gaps, but we have an amazing amount of information now about how we became human.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I have one last question for you, Tim. Let me ask you this. You know, every time there's a major breakthrough in science, it raises all kinds of new questions. It answers a lot of the old questions. It causes a lot of struggle among scientists, and really one would hope that it would cause a lot of conversation and struggle among the population at large as well, at least significant portions of it. And the more we learn about science, hopefully that'll increase. But it raises all kinds of new questions. What are the questions that it's raised for you? What are you thinking about right now in the wake of the discovery of Skull 5 and all that you've talked about it meaning?
We run a project, my Ethiopian colleague Berhane Asfaw in Addis Ababa and Gidewaldi Gabriel at Los Alamos. We run a project in the Afar of Ethiopia near the junction of the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. We go to Ethiopia every fall, and this year is no exception. We'll go right after Thanksgiving. And we're going out into beds that are a little bit older than these Dimanisi fossils, and we hope to fill more of these gaps with the discoveries we make. And we, what we'd really like to know is, what does a direct comparison between Africa and Eurasia yield, not just in terms of the remains of the human ancestors, but all of the other mammals that we can find in these deposits, as well as the cultural items left behind by these human ancestors. So you're absolutely right. Science is an ongoing question. It's a series of questions that, when you fill one gap, it opens a gap on either side. It poses interesting questions that we can then pursue critically. And certainly the ideas that these authors put forth on Skull 5 will be tested. That's the beauty of science. It has a creative aspect from discovery, and it has a critical aspect. And that's what's going on here in Los Angeles, paleontologists talking to one another, formulating hypotheses, going out and testing those hypotheses. It's reality-based. It's not fiction-based.
All right, Tim, thank you very much. What a great way to wind this up. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Have a great weekend.
All right, thanks. You too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Tim White, Professor Tim White, who's he's a paleoanthropologist and a professor of integrative biology at UC Berkeley. And he's talking about the recently published analysis of fossils found in the Republic of Georgia, which casts important new light on the evolution of human beings. The earliest now extinct human ancestors, once thought to be multiple species, may actually have been one species. So that's a trip. How about that one? And if you want to follow me, you can on Facebook and Twitter. And actually, I've heard that if you like me on Facebook, I get superpowers very quickly after I reach a certain number of likes. I don't know what they are yet, but we'll find out when I start exercising my superpower. So like me. So many of you like me, and we'll conquer the world, okay? All right, so we're going to go out now with Bad Religion, and it's a long way to the promised land.
It's a long way to the promised land, so you better well know your way. There's a ship on the ocean and an albatross who is trying to lead you astray.